afternoon. Delighted to welcome you all, but we have a special welcome for students from the Fox Valley Technical College. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Yeah, we have a program at the court sponsored with the State Bar of Wisconsin that invites students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if the students accept the invitation, they may have gotten materials that relate to the case that we are about to hear. And then they meet with a justice who has been assigned for that day to meet with students who come. And I'm told that these students did meet with Justice Prosser after the second oral argument this morning. If anyone in the courtroom would like a summary of the case, would you raise your hand and then give you a summary so you can better understand the case we're about to hear? Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left is a chair which is empty today, but usually occupied by Justice Michael Gableman, who says that he is going to listen to the oral argument and participate in the decision-making in this case. So we shall see how that proceeds. Let me call the third case for today, 11-AP-2916-CR, State versus Andrew M. Edler. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General David H. Perlman. Mr. Perlman, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief, and good afternoon, Justices. Of the three issues that were certified to this court by the Court of Appeals, arguably the one of most global impact is whether this court should endorse the United States Supreme Court 2010 ruling in Maryland v. Schatzer. The state says that it should. The state views Schatzer as both remedial and expansive, and as a result, provides good protection for Wisconsin citizens. It is expansive in that it changes the Edwards protections which would dissipate during a break in custody to now lasting 14 continuous days after a break in custody. It is remedial because it prevents the possibility for police abuse which occurred up until its holding. And that is, and I have to confess that when Edwards was first decided, it was unclear as to whether or not Edwards' protections would stop when a person is immediately released from custody. However, every case that interpreted it from that point on held that that was the case. And in Maryland v. Schatzer, the United States Supreme Court made it very clear that that was their understanding as well, that the rule was that they were dealing with at that time was that Edwards' protections stop the moment a person is released from custody. That allows for potential for police abuse in the sense that a person could be released from custody for a couple of seconds, wipe the slate clean, and get rearrested. And the Supreme Court in Schatzer noted that potential and said that one of the benefits of its decision was that that would no longer be possible because of the 14-day period. So I believe this case is expansive and remedial. Now, I want to address another side issue that kind of lurks in the background here and why I, as the state, did not seek to raise it as a pertinent issue, and that is, can a defendant who is in custody, and there's no dispute the defendant was in custody in this case, anticipatorily invoke his Miranda right? In other words, invoke his right far before the reading of the warning. And this court held in State v. Hambly, and I believe clearly held, it's possible. Yes, a person who is in custody can assert their right. The court, however, was divided as to when that moment would happen in custody where they could do the assertion. On the temporal issue, would it mean when the investigation is impending, when it is imminent, when it is far behind? I decided to leave it for another day on this case because we had a minimum of 15 minutes. The record is unclear, but it was 15 minutes from the time that he made the comment that is the subject of this dispute until the moment he was read his rights. And whether that would fit in imminent or immediate, I don't really want to reopen on this case that can of worms whether or not that would fit the temporal people as opposed to the people who say the moment's in custody. So for the sake of argument, the state for this case is leaving that for another day and is willing to address the issue that did he or did he not assert his Miranda rights? Under Schatzer, the police were clearly allowed to interrogate Mr. Edler because while he had asserted his Miranda right to a lawyer, he had been released for 19 continuous days out of custody from the assertion to the new moment. 19 days, 5 more days than Schatzer. So if the court adopts the Schatzer statute, as the state urges that it does, then clearly under Schatzer, the police were free to try to interrogate Edler again.
Counselor, they are free unless his question, can my attorney be present for that, is a sufficient invocation. And that's the issue that interests me quite a lot. And it interests me from this perspective. Davis talks about it, but in Davis, there had been a waiver of the right to counsel. And in Davis, it was said, well, it has to be an unambiguous statement. Here, you got the break, okay? They're starting up again, and he asks right away, can my attorney be present for that? He's 17 years old. He was told yes. Why isn't that sufficient?
Here's my – I would argue that that particular statement, and I agree with you, Justice, that that is a very key issue in this case, going beyond Schatzer. Assuming for the moment that Schatzer is applicable, that issue still remains. I would argue that that is not an ambiguous assertion, but rather a clear question.
Why does it have to be ambiguous, Why does it have to be unambiguous when he's never waived? You got the break from Schatzer, so you're at a clean slate now.
At a clean slate.
Yep. Okay, so why does it have to be unambiguous? That's the Davis issue that I find very interesting. But in Davis, there was a waiver. Here, there's no waiver. Got
well, because it, in order to get the protections of Edwards, one has to assert their Miranda right to a lawyer. Edwards is not an automatic right that happens. It happens upon the assertion.
Well, I understand.
Did he assert or did he not assert?
Okay. And why isn't his question, when he gets answered yes, enough? Why isn't that enough for a 17-year-old kid to say to an officer, well, can my lawyer be present for that? Officer says, yeah. Why shouldn't the young man think his lawyer's going to show up at the court, at the jail?
Okay. Thank you. I would not challenge that 17-year-old is young, but I would also say that while he is a kid, he is not inexperienced in the criminal justice system. He knows how to assert his rights. He clearly had done so 19 days earlier. The colloquialism, can I, is an interesting one. And we have a lot of can I cases, and most of the can I cases go against the state. I will concede. Here is where I think the difference is, and here where I think it does become an issue as to the timing of the comment. I believe that almost every case that I read that was cited by opposing counsel, cited in the certification, in which can I meant I want, occurred after the reading of the Miranda warning. That's a different situation because when a person says, can I have my lawyer after the Miranda warning, you can't call that a question. He knows the answer. He's already been read the warning. He knows he has that right. Can I have it is like saying a waitress saying, you can have a Diet Coke, you can have a lemonade, or you can have an orange juice. Can I have an orange juice? That's not a question. That's, I want an orange juice. You've been read your rights. You know you can have an attorney. Can I have an attorney? This is 20 minutes before that. Plus, I think it's an interesting question. He knows he has a lawyer. So does the other, so does the cop, about a different matter, a burglary matter. So it's a very interesting question to ask. I have a lawyer for the burglary matter.
I bet he doesn't know that distinction. I think that's a very important distinction under the law, but I'll bet you he doesn't know that distinction.
Well,
I think he thinks he's got a lawyer. I don't think he thinks I got a lawyer for burglary, now I got to get another lawyer or rehire the same lawyer for the arson.
I appreciate what you're saying, although if you look at the entire record of his contact with the police, he's not quite as naive as you would suggest, does know how to assert his rights, does know how to ask questions about his rights, and does appear to have the posture of somebody who is mulling over his options. Can I have my lawyer for this? Even though let's concede that he does a burglary with the Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, which drives lawyers crazy,
yes,
it's pretty hard to say that a 17-year-old's got command of that. It's still an informational question when it's given that far away from it. And the officer answered. And that becomes important when we start talking about the issue of clarification. The officer didn't, as they did in so many other of the cases cited, either ignore the question.
Well, he said yes.
He said yes. He answered the question. Plus, what are we protecting Etler from 20 minutes beforehand? He is going to be read his rights. He is going to be read his rights in its entirety. He is going to have that prophylactic measure. So he, in a sense, is wanting protection from the extra protection of being read his rights in the first place.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think I wrote separately on a case where I didn't agree you had to wait to the last minute, that any time you ask for it when you're in custody is okay. And that's still what's troubling me with this, is this a sufficient ask? You know, if I go in a restaurant and I say, can I have a bowl of soup?
Yes.
They know I'm asking for some soup.
Right.
Okay, why isn't, can my lawyer be present not asking for his lawyer?
Well, first of all, can my lawyer be present for this? Again, as I said, if you did that after the reading of the rights, when you know clearly the answer to that question, when you were ordering at a restaurant, you know clearly the can I answer. It's either on the menu or on the board, so you know you can. So when you know you can.
You're out of soup. Not likely, right? Okay.
But I say when you know you can, the question can I, which is not imperfect, it's imperfectly worded, but I'm not going to play that semantic game. I say can I, everybody in this room said can I occasionally, meaning I want, but I think can I means I want.
That's the whole problem with the concept of whether or not it's an ambiguous or unambiguous request. What might be ambiguous to you might be unambiguous to someone else, but the court ultimately makes a decision whether it's ambiguous or unambiguous, right?
That's correct.
And in our cases, I think if you look at them, most of the time, unless the person says, I want a lawyer now, or I want a lawyer and I'm not going to talk to you until I get a lawyer, short of that, I think the court's been unfriendly to statements by the defendant intimating that he's thinking about a lawyer, right? So if the guy says, do you think I should have a lawyer, or I think I should have a lawyer, it's not going to pass muster. It hasn't passed muster in the cases. Maybe you disagree with that.
No, do I think I have a lawyer has been litigated and found not to be sufficient.
Right. And so it really takes an absolute affirmative statement, usually to require a lawyer.
Well,
now, do you think we should have a different test pre- and post-Miranda? Isn't that the question in this case?
It's a this, unlike, I would argue, whether or not Schatzer applies, is the totality of the circumstance look. I will concede in all the cases that wrestle with it, there's a lot of legal, there's a lot of semantic arm wrestling. But I would say you would look at the context of when the statement is made as a key factor. I would think.
Okay, so here's what's the context in this case? The guy has already said, I wanted a lawyer. It was 19 days ago.
Yes.
But he said that.
He said it clearly.
He knows he can have a lawyer and has a lawyer in a different case. He's 17. Has experience with the criminal justice system. He's in the back of a police car. He knows he's arrested, right? He's in custody. No question about that. He knows he's in custody, right? And he knows the routine, which is that he's going to be questioned, right?
Yes.
And he says, can I have a lawyer, right? So what in that context tells you he doesn't want a lawyer?
Well, with due respect, and I think each word is important.
Sure.
He does not say, can I have a lawyer?
Right.
He says, can my lawyer be present for this? I would argue the second is...
Absolutely good. That, to me, is even stronger, which is why I rephrased it. Can my lawyer be present when? When I am questioned, which you are going to do as soon as you get me out of this car.
Yes, but
isn't that the context?
The context, again, this is a person who has been arrested 19 days earlier,
mm-hmm.
who has been through the system within that context, who knows he has a lawyer on one case. Mm-hmm. Whether he can articulate Fifth or Sixth Amendment, I agree with Justice Rogensack, it's naive to think he would.
Listen, we have a hard time distinguishing between the two.
Right.
Why
but
should
I do
he?
Think... But I do think it's a legitimate question to know. I know I'm not going to be questioned about this. Can my lawyer be present for this? Is my lawyer an all-serving entity? And the question was answered. My argument is...
Was the question answered correctly? I mean, don't you think he meant my lawyer, meaning the lawyer he has on the burglary?
Yes, I think that's
and
correct.
Do you think that that lawyer automatically would represent him on this matter?
I think any lawyer could be present, and if he's saying, can my lawyer be present, I believe that question was answered correctly. Yeah.
Well, but his lawyer is for a different case, right?
Yes, but
he's saying my attorney. Don't you think he means the attorney that's representing him?
Absolutely.
And he doesn't necessarily have the right to have that particular attorney present, does he?
Well, no, I would think that he has the right to have any attorney that he chooses be present for this.
So when Urban answered, yes, he can, Urban was essentially saying, sure, you can have the same lawyer in the burglary present for this.
Yes. I would think that that's the way that was understood because Urban and him had a prior relationship. They know he had an attorney. Whether I can't speak for it, the record silenced exactly what was going on in his brain, but I felt that the officer felt that it was an informational question, and he gave the answer. Yes, you can have an attorney. Now, whether the answer
was... He asked for an attorney. He said my attorney, though. That's my point. And the answer is, you know, basically inferring, sure, you're going to have the same lawyer represent you in both cases.
So the answer you would have preferred might have been, yes, your attorney could be present for this if you qualify for him, if it's a public defender, or if you choose to pay him...
I just don't know that the answer is accurate. Yes, he can. You know, I guess it's possible, but someone else could show up, too, someone from the public defender's office, someone his family hires, somebody that he decides to select, somebody else that the public defender appoints, someone that the court appoints. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be the exact same person. He might be in court.
I see your point, but I fail to see its impact on the reasoning of this decision.
Was that lawyer there, present for the questioning?
No. When they arrived at the scene, at the interrogation scene, he was read his rights in its entirety, and there was no more mention of that lawyer. There was some Q&A, though, between him and the police officer. Again, I want to bring this up. If you read all the cases that are cited by the opposing side that deal with clarification and all that, in those cases, police didn't even answer the questions. They wanted it both ways. They were saying it's not an ambiguous assertion, it's a question, yet they wouldn't even answer the question. In one of the cases cited right after reading his rights, he says, how long do I have to wait for my lawyer? And they didn't even answer the question. And here the question was answered. Now, whether it was technically correctly answered or not, for purposes, I think, in terms of the rights of Mr. Edler, it was answered in a way that would give momentum to his knowledge that he could have an attorney present there. It's just that it becomes difficult when we go in such an anticipatory fashion to 15 minutes before we get to the theater. And when I look at that, I view can the lawyer be present for this as, and I think our discussion suggests, it's ambiguous.
Or
a clear question.
You started out a few minutes ago talking about the fact that we have to make a determination here based on the totality of the circumstances. One of the circumstances that I look at in all of this is the fact that within 15 or 20 minutes, whatever it is, he's read his Miranda rights, he waives those rights, and he makes no further mention of having his attorney present. Is that significant, or does that in any way enter into what our determination should be here?
Well, I agree with the Court of Appeals that said it's dangerous for us to look at post assertion or ambiguous assertion conduct to determine whether the original assertion was ambiguous. However, I'd say it is important in the sense of the police behavior in this case. The police, I think, always responded to his questions. If in the middle of reading the Miranda warning, he was saying, but can my lawyer be present for this, I would say we would have a different case than we do here. If you're looking for a line, and if I was in your shoes, I would be, because it's very difficult, this ambiguity thing. And we don't have much case law to guide us when it's that far removed, the comment from the actual Miranda reading theater. I would say that if you're going to use the colloquialism, can I, as opposed to I want, I need, I have to have, or something like that, when you say can I, when you're doing it before the rights are even read, that is a question. And if we're concerned about Edler's ultimate rights, as we all are, we don't want Edler ultimately to be victimized, he's going to be read his rights in his entirety. At that time, he's going to have that opportunity to really express his issue. And he did go into it, or he didn't go into his particular attorney. And that's why I'm looking at it within that context. Well, all the cases that we have where there's some division occurs with either the police completely ignoring the question or plunging into rights ignoring the question or trying to dissuade him from getting an attorney in the first place. And that's not what we have here.
Well, Schatzer tries to create a bright-line rule, right? 14 days.
Yes.
Should we have a bright-line rule?
Yes.
What should it be?
14 days. I think we should endorse the Schatzer rule, and here's why.
No, but I'm carrying it further into the question, can I have my attorney present?
Oh, I would say that, again, I don't think we can have a complete bright-line rule because this is a very fact-intensive inquiry. However, I would say if doing a fact-intensive inquiry, when the comment is made, as it is here, even before a person has read his rights, that these colloquialisms, can I or whatever, that would not be ambiguous after the reading of the rights when he knows that he can, are ambiguous before the reading of the rights. So I would make the reading of the rights. The reading of the rights is the defining time, because if I say to you, after you read me my rights, you go right to a lawyer, and 5 minutes later saying, can I have a lawyer, to me that means I'm ordering from the restaurant and I want my soup. But if I do it 20 minutes before I even know of this right, that's a question.
Didn't he know of his rights here? I mean, this is a guy who, what was it, 17, 18 days before, invoked his right to counsel, said, yeah, I want a lawyer present.
But if we go too strict on that, then we'd go down the slippery slope of saying he knows his rights once, he should never be re-read it, and we never go there. We understand that even though he was read his rights once, that was 19 days ago, the police have got to read him again. We don't expect these people to retain every particular right at that time. Otherwise, you open up a terrible slippery slope there. So I would say it's 19 days. We start fresh. He said, can my lawyer be present for this 20 minutes before you get there? That is, I would say it's ambiguous. It was answered. Then we get there. He's read his rights. There's a discussion about what having a lawyer will be there. That's a discussion that the officer did not ignore. That continued to engage him in the discussion and ultimately.
Now, on this, sir, you done?
No, I've got one more question.
Go ahead.
Let's assume for a minute that you're training police officers.
Yes.
And I know that the AG's office does that. Should police officers be trained so that they act like we often see on television? They take the guy into custody and immediately they give that person the Miranda rights. You see that all the time on television.
Yes, we definitely should not train them that way, and we do not train them that way.
Why?
The reason we don't train them that way, Justice Crooks, is because you don't need to read the Miranda warning unless two things are present. They are in custody, and you are going to interrogate them. And so often, if you just jump on the rights after the arrest, they'll probably lawyer, they could lawyer up then, and you've denied your chance to have the best opportunity you can to read him his rights and see what his opinion of the lawyer is. It's good on TV. It's good on movies. I think the reason they put it in TV and movies is because it tells the audience what's going on, and they expect it. But from a legal standpoint, it's not a real strategically smart move What you do is you arrest the defendant in a reasonable, respectful manner. He goes into the squad. You drive to the place. If you're going to talk, you talk about the Brewers or a happier subject, depending. And you get to the location.
Or the Cubs, perhaps.
And that's a tale of two cities, isn't it?
Now, Mr. Perlman, what you expect is that the arrested person might just want to talk about why he was being arrested and what's on his mind. And it's all volunteered, and it's before Miranda, and it's before he knows he has a right to a lawyer there, and you can use it against him. Isn't that really one of the points?
Let's be forthright. Chief, what I teach on that, or others teach, I don't want to sound like Noah Webster here, but when I do teach on that, what I say is, when you get in the squad, just drive them to the place. If you must engage in small talk, keep it very tiny. If they suddenly start volunteering things, you're a police officer. Your eyes are always open. Your ears are always receptive.
That's
you
right.
Do not ask follow-up questions.
That's right.
If you ask a follow-up
question,
just
let them talk.
Then it's an interrogation. Let them talk. And they sometimes do. They most times don't. In this particular case, Adler asked his question, got his answer, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
For another 15 minutes. And the record's not clear what they talked about, but...
You know, we get certified three questions. One is, do we adopt Shasta? And that it would say that you can question 14 days after. In words, an effect doesn't necessarily apply, right?
I would say that after 14 continuous days upon release, then the Edward rule is relaxed.
Okay. Issue number two, can I have my attorney present? This is when he's under arrest, but no, when he's in custody, but no questions have been asked. The second issue is, did he unambiguously invoke his right to counsel? And you would say it was ambiguous.
I would say it was either an ambiguous assertion or a clear question that was answered.
Okay. And their issue three is, if the statement is declared to be ambiguous, which you say it is, then we ask that the Supreme Court resolve a third issue. Does it make a difference whether the ambiguous statement was made before Miranda warnings as opposed to afterwards? On the theory that if it's made afterwards and it's ambiguous, then you have to do further questioning to clarify the ambiguity. So do you have to do further questioning when it's a pre-Miranda ambiguous statement?
I would argue that if it's a pre-waiver, ambiguous statement, there is no need to clarify. The basis for that is the ultimate clarification is upcoming in the reading of the rights and his response to that. I would also say that in the cases that seem to require some kind of clarification in the middle of the reading of the rights or after, in every instance, the police didn't answer their questions. And I would say that it's more of an answering question thing here. They just ignored it completely and proceeded. So you had a situation where a person's read his rights, and then he says, can I have a lawyer? Ignored. How long can I wait for that lawyer? Ignored. And that is, in those kind of contexts, yeah, there's some need for clarification. I think the least clarification is to answer the questions, and they didn't. In our case, that they did. I would say there are two schools of thought. My light is red. But I'm on a roll.
You're on a short roll.
How do I handle that?
Mr. Perlman, you're on a short roll. I gave a long roll this morning. And
I'm not going to.
There's a hostile bench. It's a long rolls.
I will finish your question with brevity.
Good.
I would just say that the tension here is that post Miranda, the theory is a person now knows his rights. He should be held to a higher standard of being clear, and that's the reason. But I would say, the flip side is, pre-Miranda, you're going to have the ultimate clarification of the reading of the Miranda warning.
May I?
Justice Prosser.
The circuit judge here was Terrence Burke.
Yes, sir.
Judge Burke, I think, a few months earlier had been upheld in the Forbush case.
I'm very familiar with the Forbush case. I wasn't familiar with whether that was Judge Burke's case or not.
I think it was Judge Burke. you think Judge Burke might have been influenced by this court's decision in the Forbush case?
Well, the Forbush case, as I recollect, was really about whether we should, among other things, adopt the Louisiana versus Montejo law here in Wisconsin. And far from me to ever be critical of this court, but the opinion in the Forbush case was varied and diverse and suggested various different component parts to this very difficult question, although ultimately I believe a majority of the justices felt that Montejo would still be good law here. I think that in Montejo, he was never read his rights, period, and he had a lawyer, and the question was, could the police reapproach there? So my argument would be that if he was influenced by that case, it wouldn't necessarily be showing here, because ultimately a majority of the justices were supportive of a sort of pro-police notion that even though a person has hired a lawyer, that is not the same as asserting their Miranda right to a lawyer, that those are two different acts.
I see this, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that Montejo sort of was a retreat from the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Sixth Amendment, the nature of the Sixth Amendment right. Here, one might see Shatker as something of a retreat from Edwards. And maybe one might respond the same way.
I agree completely with the first part of your premise, and that is definitely Montejo is a retreat in Sixth Amendment law. If by retreat you mean more rights to the police at the expense of the individual, because it clearly overruled itself in Michigan v. Jackson. I would respectfully disagree that Schatzer restricts Edwards. I view it as a pro-defense, wrong way to put it. I view it as a case that is taking a high interest in the individual rights of each person. It expands Edwards from its de facto institutionalized, upon release, it's gone, to 14 continuous days, and it's also remedial preventing the problem. So I would say if we're going to sit and synopsize these cases, that the court in Montejo, a little more in that balance between the ferreting out crime and criminals and preserving our rights, a little more on the ferreting out crime and criminals side, and in Maryland v. Schatzer, much more on preserving the rights of the individual.
Right. In Schatzer, you talk about releasing. He was in custody all the time. Wasn't he in prison in Schatzer?
Yeah, Schatzer's facts are different than ours, dramatically.
He's questioned in prison.
Right.
And then 2 years later, or more, mm-hmm. he's questioned again. He's still in prison. But they just have a time delay between two questioning. Isn't that the point?
Right. And they also held, it's kind of a bifurcated opinion. On the one side, it's holding 14 days. On the other side, it's saying that when you're in prison for a sustained period of time, it ceases to be custodial. It's a bit of a non-starter for logic, but the theory is that's become your home.
That was Stevens' concurrence, wasn't it? And they debated about the 14 days. Do I have the right U.S. Supreme Court case?
The critics of Schatzer wonder where Scalia got his 14 days
well,
from.
So did Stevens. And Scalia's answer was, hey, 14, 21, you got to get it somewhere, and that Stevens has to get a time period that's reasonable from somewhere, and you'd rather have a bright line 14 than not bright line.
Yes, and I think, when zero, which has been the default position, has worked or has been in effect, expanding it by 2 weeks, 14 days seems sufficient. I mean, it'd be very difficult to know what number works, but 14 days. I agree with you that Justice Scalia was a bit cavalier in defending his 14 days, almost the equivalent of because I can, but...
Can I have my attorney present?
Back to can. I'm using can in a different context.
Well, here's the other difference between Schatzer and this case is apparently they never questioned him again. the police. Now, in this case, the police don't question him, but they haven't let him go. They wire up somebody who becomes, in effect, their agent. It's not a police officer, who questions the suspect about the arson. Isn't that right?
Yes, but that also occurred past 14 days, Your Honor. So if you're going to make some kind of agency argument, the police would still be asking somebody to do what they themselves could be able to do under Schatzer. It's 14 days is the defining point, and I think that was day 18. If Schatzer had said 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, I don't think my opinion would change. I think we want a bright-line rule that preserves our citizens, and our citizens have two interests. Their interest is so that when their time comes, they have rights. But they also have an interest that people who do bad things are held accountable to it, and confessions is one of the ways that we hold people accountable.
Right.
And I think a 14-day waiting period sufficiently meets both those interests.
You know, this is the 50th anniversary of Gideon, the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the public defender system in the state, the one that I think we're operating under now. So I've had opportunity to read in this area. So I went back to an 1859 Wisconsin Supreme Court case. You know, the one I'm going to cite is Carpenter versus County of Dane, 9 Wis. 274. And in this case, way before the U.S. Constitution had bearing on the Bill of Rights for the states, and way before public defenders, this court, in a decision written by Justice Cole, said that Dane County had to provide, at county expense, or at least public expense, a lawyer. Because, and would it not be a little like mockery to secure to a pauper these solemn constitutional guarantees? And they went to compulsory process, self-incrimination, right of confrontation, etc. Mockery to secure to a pauper these solemn constitutional guarantees for fair and full trial of the matters with which he was charged, and yet say to him, when on trial, that he must employ his own counsel who could alone render these guarantees of any real permanent value to him. You know, we have become so complicated on the right to counsel. Is it ambiguous? Is it not ambiguous? Is it pre-Miranda? Is it post-Miranda? Is it 15 minutes in the squad car? Is it 14 days thereafter? I mean, the real point is to give people their rights, and their rights are guaranteed if they want a lawyer. And we've just moved so far. Doesn't it bother you, Mr. Perlman? Bothers me.
Yeah. Yes, it would bother me, but I would say this, and I think this court itself noted it just a couple of days ago in your opinion in Lonsinski that came out. The Miranda warning. The Miranda decision, in my view, is one of the great decisions of criminal jurisprudence. It gives us, it's an unfair situation. A lot of these things are unfair, but we have to create legal fictions to make it fair. It's unfair. You have the defendant on one hand, simpering, cowering, and most of the time frightened. You have the police with all the vestiges of the state. And so you use the Miranda warning as a way to bridge that gap. And any case that would compromise the reading of the warning is where my concern would be. But when I ask myself this, did Edler get a fair shot? I would say he did. He got a fair shot when he asserted his right to a lawyer on March 30th and the cop stopped talking to him. He got a fair shot when he got his lawyer the next day, unlike the 1859 situation. He got a fair shot when the next time when he was arrested, he was read his rights in its entirety. He got a fair shot when he asked a question and was answered correctly. He got a fair shot when, after the reading of the Miranda warning, he asked some follow-up questions of its implications and got correct answers. He got a fair shot. Society wants him to get a fair shot, but society also wants that if he commits serious crime, he'll be accountable to it. And if you hold in the way that I'm asking you to, I think both those goals are accomplished. And I really went beyond my role I hope I have.
I'll pay for this, Mr. Perlman, by giving you this amount of time. You may be seated.
Thank you.
Christopher Heppert, who will represent Andrew M. Elder. Counsel?
Justices, counsel, good afternoon. As the Chief Justice indicated, my name is Christopher Eipert. I'm with the law firm of Holden & Hahn in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and we represent the defendant respondent in this case, Andrew Edler. I think it is important in addressing all the issues of this case to have a clear understanding of the facts. So I'd like to try to, as briefly as possible, summarize an affront to end. Mr. Edler was being investigated in early 2011 for a number, both a burglary and then two separate arsons. He was brought into custody by Detective Edler, the Sheboygan County Sheriff's Department, on March 30th. He was given his Miranda rights with respect to the burglary investigation. He ultimately made some admissions with respect to that. Detective Urban then went into interrogating him with respect to the arsons. Mr. Edler, over a course of about 20 to 30 minutes, made numerous exculpatory statements, denied any involvement in the arsons. Detective Urban became more pressing. It got a little more aggressive. And at that point, Mr. Edler said, "From this point on, I'd like my lawyer here." Now, Detective Urban followed Edwards, and he stopped questioning him with respect to those arsons. But I think it's important to note that for several minutes, Detective Urban continued talking to Mr. Edler. He said, "I understand you want a lawyer, but you better understand that it's going to be important for you to cooperate in this matter going forward. I have evidence in this case, and it's all pointing at you." And he left Mr. Edler with that.
Well, didn't he repeat the father's warning or guidance to the son?
That was on the 20th, the second time he was taken into custody. Mm-hmm. Yes. On March 31st, a day after this initial interrogation, he had been arrested on March 30th for the burglary. He was taken into custody. There was apparently some confusion, but Mr. Edler requested to meet with Detective Urban on March 31st. Detective Urban and his partner, of course, were hoping that this was going to be an exception to Edwards, and Mr. Edler was going to say, "I want to talk to you more." But it turned out to be just a clarification, "When am I going to court on my burglary case?" Detective Urban said, "Well, are you sure you don't want to talk to me anymore about the arson? Is that what this is about?" And Mr. Edler made clear, "I have nothing to say to you about that." So on the 30th and the 31st, Mr. Edler made clear that he didn't want to talk to Detective Urban or law enforcement about the arsons, and certainly not without counsel. He is released on April 1st, the next day, after he's charged with the burglary. He's appointed counsel through the public defender's office. It's undisputed that Detective Urban, in following the arson and following the burglary, is aware of this. There is some further investigation that's done. They do this covert wire, as the chief referenced earlier.
What date was that?
That was on April 18th.
Mm-hmm.
That was 17 days after he was released from custody. Based on the information obtained through that and other investigation, Detective Urban decided to arrest Mr. Edler on the 20th. He went to Mr. Edler's home. Mr. Edler's father was there. Detective Urban specifically made a point to go to his father and say, "Your son needs to cooperate in this manner. He hasn't been cooperative up to this point. He needs to cooperate." In step with that, as Mr. Edler's being placed in the car, his father goes there and says, "You need to cooperate in this matter. You need to help yourself out." There's some discussion during Attorney Perlman's argument that they encourage small talk on the way to the department. There's about a 15-minute ride in this case from rural Sheboygan County to the city of Sheboygan. Detective Urban didn't make small talk. He didn't ask how the Brewers were playing. It's probably right about the time the season was starting in 2011. He repeated what he told his dad back where he had arrested him. "You still have an opportunity to help yourself out. You need to tell the truth. All the evidence we have is pointing at you. And we'll talk about it more later. And everybody knew what that meant. And when we get to the sheriff's department, I'm going to interrogate you about this. And that's when Mr. Edler stated, can my attorney be present for this?
Well, are you saying that that small, quote, small talk was interrogation or the functional equivalent of interrogation? That is the Christian burial speech, if I remember that right.
I don't believe it was was interrogation, but I believe it was sly tactics on the part of Detective Urban.
Sly tactics are acceptable.
They are acceptable in a normal case, but I think this case is distinguishable because of what happened back on March 30th. And what happened back on March 30th is he said, I clearly want to deal with this case only with an attorney. I believe that Detective Urban's tactics were trying to get Mr. Edler to give up that previously asserted right.
Is there any dispute about the dialogue in the car?
No, the entire record with respect to that dialogue is from Detective Urban's report. It is not recorded, so it's taken from his report. Detective Urban had a fairly detailed report indicating that I said these things to Mr. Edler. I told him he had an opportunity to help himself out, that he needed to cooperate in this. Told him we'd talk about it more later at the department, and that's when he said, can my attorney be present for this? And the sole response was, yes, he can. According to that report, there's no indication of any further conversation between the two of them in the remaining 10 minutes or so drive. In the interrogation room, the video makes clear that Mr. Edler, I recall he's just 17 years old. Yes, he had some experience in the criminal justice system, but that was based on an interrogation from 19 days before that, or 20 days before that. He's crying pretty uncontrollably, heavy breathing, unusually heavy breathing. At the conclusion of the interview, he actually vomits. He is in a stressful situation. Nonetheless, prior to reading any Miranda rights, Detective Urban states to him, again, I've done a lot of investigation on this case. Everything points at you. This is your opportunity to help yourself out. Knowing full well, 20 days ago, said, from this point on, I'd like a lawyer here. And just 15 minutes ago, said, can my attorney be present for this? And everyone knows what this was. This was the interrogation that's going to happen in 15 minutes. Because that was right after Detective Urban said, we'll talk about it more at the department. Finally, after all this, Detective Urban goes through the standard Miranda waiver. Edler asks some questions to try to clarify whether having an attorney present will make any difference as to whether he has to sit in jail. Detective Urban says no, it won't make any difference. And after everything that's been put at him, you need to cooperate. After on April 20th, when he didn't cooperate, he was arrested and taken into custody. What do you think he's going to do? He talked. And he made some admissions to the arsons. And based in part on those admissions, he was charged with 2 counts of arson and 1 count of manufacturing a Molotov cocktail. Now the court spent a lot of time, Mr. Perlman's argument, discussing ambiguous statements, unambiguous statements. Now Wisconsin, I agree with Mr. Perlman, has never addressed a situation like this in many respects. But the limited situation of what Mr. Edler said on April 20th, can my attorney be present for this? They have addressed, this court has addressed situations, do you think I need an attorney? And I agree clearly that is not an unambiguous request for counsel. That is a question as to an opinion of the officer.
Counselor, I noticed that you say unambiguous request for counsel is your standard. Is there a time when an ambiguous request for counsel puts a burden on the officer to clarify what the the person in custody is speaking about.
Yes. Wisconsin courts do not seem to have addressed this issue, but a number of other courts have. And while not uniformly, the large majority of other jurisdictions to have addressed that issue hold that in certain circumstances an ambiguous request can lead to some requirement on law enforcement. And specifically, that situation is when the alleged ambiguous request is before any Miranda waiver is made. The Davis case in the United States Supreme Court and the Jennings case here in Wisconsin that adopted that standard, while I wouldn't say it's clear, the language of those decisions demonstrate that the unequivocal standard applies only to requests for counsel post-waiver. Now, I cited numerous, probably a dozen, out-of-state cases that upheld that before a waiver, it's a different standard. And that if an arguably ambiguous request for counsel is made at that time, most of those courts hold that the only questions that law enforcement can ask at that point are questions in order to clarify whether the officer, or whether the suspect wants his attorney there. I believe it's undisputed that this did not happen in this case. The only response from Detective Urban was, yes, he can, which presumably would have led Mr. Edler to believe that he was going to be allowed to be there.
Counsel, what is your position specifically here? Is your position that the statement made by your client in the police car about whether or not he could have his attorney present was ambiguous, or do you think it was unambiguous?
Unambiguous, Justice.
Okay, let's assume for a minute that I think it's ambiguous. Is your position then that under Davis and under Jennings that the officer should have, because it was pre-Miranda warnings, should have clarified what was being requested or not requested?
Yes, and to be clear, Davis and Jennings don't say that.
I know.
But yes, the answer is yes, that at most is what he was allowed to do. At most, the majority of these out-of-state cases that I cited to indicate that that's the appropriate thing that an officer should do at that point. However, the Sessoms case from the Ninth Circuit, which the Court of Appeals in our case referred to, and which is really the most current case that addresses the pre-waiver, post-waiver distinction, appears to suggest that even in a pre-waiver situation, or at least in a situation where the Miranda rights have not been read yet, that if there's an arguable invocation or an ambiguous invocation, that there can be nothing after that. In our case, it doesn't matter. If he wasn't allowed to have any questions beyond that, and under Edwards must cut off questioning, that obviously didn't happen because he continued to do questioning later. So all his statements must be suppressed. But even under these other states that hold that it should be limited to clarifying questions, he didn't do that either. And therefore, it would be suppressed under that theory as well.
Well, how does the fact that in a short time later, 15 or 20 minutes, your client has now read his Miranda rights, and he waives those rights. How does that enter into all of this?
Well, number one, Edwards is clear that just reading Miranda rights to somebody after they've requested their right to counsel is not enough. The suspect either has to initiate the conversation themselves, or law enforcement has to provide an attorney. And certainly that didn't happen in this case.
Or you've got 14 days. How does that enter into all of this?
It's a little convoluted because we have a lot of different issues here.
Right.
I think everybody recognizes that. The 14-day, when it comes to determining whether it was ambiguous, whether it was unambiguous, doesn't have a significant amount of play, except in the respect that Detective Urban knew that 14 days before, he had clearly said, from this point on, I'd like an attorney here. I think that makes his request on April 20th unambiguous. Can my attorney be present for this? I'm not sure if I exactly answered your question.
You have. It is convoluted, and it's hard to fit some of these cases with other cases.
In trying to answer your prior question about is just the reading of Miranda rights 15 minutes later sufficient clarification of a arguably ambiguous request for counsel? No, it's definitely not. And the Sessoms case is right on point on that case. In that case, the suspect was brought into custody before any rights were read, and he made statements that were arguably ambiguous. Just to be clear, he said, there wouldn't be any possible way that I could have a lawyer present while I do this. Yeah, that's what my dad asked me to ask you guys, give me a lawyer. In that case, the majority, although there was a concurrent opinion that made things a little unclear, but held that even if that statement is ambiguous, that it's held to a lower standard. Specifically, instead of the unequivocal standard of Davis, all that the statement has to do is that it must be reasonably construed to be an expression of a desire for the assistance of an attorney, but the assertion need not be unambiguous or unequivocal. And they were taking quotes right from Davis and from McNeil, United States Supreme Court cases, which they believe applied to a pre-waiver situation. Now, in Sessoms, after he made those arguably ambiguous statements, police did something very similar to what they did in this case. They said, absolutely, you have the right to an attorney, but you know we have all this evidence against you. If you have an opportunity to help yourself out, best to cooperate. Same type of things that Detective Urban did in this case. And then, after they made those statements, okay, we're going to read you your rights now. They read the rights. There was no deficiency in the rights. And after that, Sessoms said, let's talk, and made incriminating statements. The Ninth Circuit found that the reading of those rights was not sufficient to overcome the previous waiver. That's what Edwards holds. And those statements were suppressed for use. And I think it's significant to note that the Sessoms Court had even a higher standard than what we're looking at here. So that was a case that was on federal habeas review of a lower court decision, which had not suppressed the statements. And so there was a high level of deference given to the lower court in that case. And the Sessoms case said that it was an unreasonable application of the unequivocal standard in Davis to the facts of that case. And they overruled the court below.
Am I right in assuming that you're going along with the 14 days rule? I mean, you don't think it helps them in this. It helps the police in this case, but you're not fighting the 14-day Shasta rule.
I am fighting. Right? We are fighting the 14-day rule.
Why?
Well,
for all cases, or the Shasta case because they were continuing the investigation within the time period. They had the guy wired after the time period.
Well, first of all, we believe that the Wisconsin Constitution should provide additional protections than the 14-day rule announced by the Schatzer Court.
And what kind of rule do you want here, then?
I believe the most practical, reasonable, and appropriate standard is a bright-line rule, much like the 14-day rule. However, it's much less arbitrary. The rule is that, with respect to a specific offense, as in this case, the arson offenses, where a person has clearly and unequivocally requested their right to counsel while in custody, that they can never again be interrogated with respect to that offense in custody.
That is a long time.
It is a long time.
Just give them a lawyer, right?
Many options.
If you don't have answering enough, my question.
Bring a lawyer in. That's option one. Number two is let him go and try to talk to him out of custody. I completely agree. I think one of the justices asked about Sean Jones. That was the informant who was wired up on April 18th. We don't believe that any evidence should be suppressed based on what happened on that day because it was out of custody. Even if it was at the instruction of law enforcement, Edwards doesn't apply in that situation because it's out of custody. We agree with that.
I have problems with the Schatzer case, whatever it is, because the 14 days to me seems like hocus pocus, and it seems to me that our jurisprudence should be based on more than grabbing a number out of a hat, although sometimes we have to engage in these legal fictions. But I have a concern about that. I also have a concern about that case because it's a retreat from Edwards. I guess I disagree with your opposing counsel, who seems to suggest that it's, what were the words?
Expansion.
It is expansive. It's an expansion. It's to benefit the defendant. I look at the words in the in that case, page 223, where it seems to me to say just the opposite. We conclude that an extension of Edwards is not justified. We have opened its, quote, protective umbrella far enough. And it goes on to say, at same page 223, we think it appropriate to specify a time period to avoid the consequences that continuation of the Edwards presumption will not reach the correct result most of the time. Then they pick this. It seems to us that period is 14 days. As I say sometimes, bingo, bango, bongo. There you have it, 14 days on page 23. But I see it as a retreat from Edwards rather than adding to Edwards' protection. Am I wrong or right on, or how do you, you don't have to say whether I'm wrong or right, how do you view it with regard to Edwards? Adding more protection or taking away protection?
I believe it is a limitation of Edwards. Now, I understand the state has cited to a number of cases, and even the Schatzer decision itself, I think, collected cases indicating that the large majority, if not all, of the lower courts disagree with our position on this, that once somebody is released from custody, the Edwards protections disappear. I believe that's not the case for a number of reasons. And it's based on the reasoning that the Schatzer court gives. Everyone agrees that 14 days is completely arbitrary. But they say it gives a person enough time to get themselves acclimated back into the community and primarily to consult with counsel about their options. I think it's significant that the Supreme Court itself in the Minnick v. Mississippi case said that even having an opportunity to consult with counsel or even consulting with them actually has no effect on the Edwards right. It does not give law enforcement an opportunity to come back in. Now, certainly that's a situation where a person remains in custody, but I think it's applicable. The Schatzer court is going directly against their prior precedent from Minnick v. Mississippi and showing and trying to explain that this 14 days gives a person enough time to consult. My position is, how do we know it's 14 days? And maybe in some cases. Mr. Edler, I don't think so. 17 years old, he doesn't know what he's what's going on. Kid who obviously is stressed out beyond belief by what's going on in his life, by the investigations that are going on. He's not thinking about these things. The test that I propose, my primary test, is that with regard to a specific offense, in this case the arson offense, that protection to be free from further investigation, custodial interrogation, should go on forever. It's not impractical. I agree that it would be impractical to have that type of protection extend to all offenses. It would be impractical because law enforcement may not be aware. Law enforcement from one jurisdiction conducting an investigation on a burglary isn't aware of the Sheboygan Sheriff's Department investigation with respect to the arson. But when it's a single investigation, it's presumably being done by the same jurisdiction, by the same investigative agency, or a joint task force, and they're all communicating. They know where Mr. Edler is. They know who wants to interrogate him. And if they want to bring him into custody 2 months later, 10 months later, 12 months later, they know, or they should know, that he's previously said, I don't want to talk to an attorney about, I don't want to talk to you guys about this without an attorney.
Well, you just keep saying that he's forever protected from custodial interrogation. But he isn't if he has a lawyer present. I mean, I watch TV too, and I see interrogation with lawyers present. I've never seen a case where there's been interrogation with a lawyer present. In the records I've seen, I don't think. But they can, if he gets a lawyer, they can interrogate him, right?
Yes. If they provide him with an attorney or he has an attorney, they can. As I said, they can do it while he's not in custody. And whether he's in custody or not, he has the right to, if he initiates it himself, they have the right to pursue that line of questioning regarding that specific.
Do you view this as a narrow case? We don't have to make a decision about someone who wasn't clear about a lawyer in prior questioning. This relates to someone who definitely, unambiguously requested a lawyer when in custodial interrogation.
Exactly, and there's no dispute that Mr. Edler did that on March 30th. Absolutely.
The end.
Well, I want to make sure we've covered everything.
I was saying that's your argument in a nutshell.
With respect to the Schatzer and whether that rule should apply in Wisconsin, I believe that the most non-arbitrary rule that can be practically applied is that rule. It's not the 14-day rule. And I believe that's what type of protection that the Wisconsin Constitution provides, as opposed to what the United States Supreme Court did in Schatzer. Now, if the court is not willing to do that, the only other option I see as a non-arbitrary test is a totality of the circumstances test. I understand that that can be a difficult test to put into effect, but
the state suggested a totality of the circumstances test too. But when I look back at my notes, I didn't say, what are we looking for under the totality of circumstances? What are we looking for? What are these totalities supposed to tell us?
I think it has to start out with a similar test as whether a statement is voluntary. I think you have to balance the characteristics of the suspect, characteristics of the defendant, and you have to balance that against the police tactics that were used. However, in this situation, the big difference is there's been a previous clear and unequivocal request for counsel. And so I believe there has to be a presumption that it's involuntary, or not that it's involuntary, but that any subsequent waiver is not an effective waiver. And I believe in this case, under all those circumstances, it would not be an effective waiver.
Well, is that what we're looking for? Under the totality of the circumstances, did the defendant waive his right to counsel? Is that what we're testing for?
On the second interrogation, on April
20th. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, we have to look at, based on the totality of the circumstances, starting back on March 30th, his clear invocation of counsel on that day, everything that happened in between, his contacts with law enforcement, the continued badgering by Detective Urban upon his arrest on the 20th, balancing that with his very limited contact with law enforcement in the past, his young age, what was going on during that interrogation, the fact that he was clearly stressed out, difficulty breathing, crying uncontrollably, and with the presumption that it's an ineffective waiver based on his prior invocation. And then one of the biggest factors is on the 20th, for a second time he says, can my attorney be present for this? That's the biggest factor in the totality of the circumstances test.
Well, under those totality of circumstances, if you use that test, then you would say that his sentence, can my lawyer be present, becomes unambiguous as a statement that he wants a lawyer, looking at it from the beginning of March 30th. Is that your point?
I just think we're somewhat mixing the arguments. I think everybody agrees that a totality of the circumstances approach is appropriate in determining whether any arguable request is either ambiguous or unambiguous. And certainly our argument under that test is that it's unambiguous.
Under this test, though, it's not a waiver because you view it as unambiguous, too.
Exactly. His statement, I noticed that my light just turned red. Thank you, Your Honor. In the totality of circumstances test, as opposed to the 14-day Schatzer test, when you determine whether the second waiver was an effective waiver of the right to counsel, his second invocation is simply one of the factors to consider, and it's a significant factor. You'll note in Schatzer, there was nothing like that. He clearly invoked 2.5 years ago, but when they came to re-interview him on the same issue, at least according to the facts as noted, as reported in Schatzer, he never once made a reference to his prior request to counsel, and he never once made any arguable request for a counsel on the second occasion. In this case, Mr. Ether obviously, at a minimum, made an ambiguous request for counsel, and that's a factor to a significant factor to consider whether that second waiver or whether his waiver was sufficient. I appreciate your time. It's been an honor to be here, and have a good afternoon.
And thank you, counsel. Mr. Perlman.
First, on Schatzer. Again, I respectfully disagree that it is a retreat from Edwards. If we were here before Schatzer, 4 years ago, most legal people would say, and every single case so held, that the Schatzer rule dissipates the moment a person is released from custody. Now, in Schatzer, it dissipates 14 days after that period of time. Secondly, let's look at the tests that Edler proposes. One is a much more complicated one than he suggests. He says, let the rule be bright line. For this particular charge, once a person invokes their right to an attorney, forevermore, when they are back in custody, for this particular charge, off limits for the police. That'd be nice if Edwards was in a vacuum. It is not. Decided shortly after Edwards was Arizona versus Roberson, a case that severely limits police in their investigations. That case held that the core issue of Edwards is not the charge, it is custody, and that any Fifth Amendment analysis cannot be charge-specific, as Edler says, but deals with the issue of custody. Under Roberson, which this Court cannot abandon and would not abandon because it would decrease the rights of its citizens, he's asking the Court to retreat from Roberson, to ignore it, saying only for this particular charge. But for any other charge, if he asserts his Miranda right to a lawyer, when he's back in custody, he's fair game. That violates the principle of Roberson that follows Edwards along as Mary's lamb followed Mary. His other test, totality of circumstances test, would almost force me to consider early retirement as a trainer of police.
What's your totality of circumstances test?
I have no totality of circumstance test when it comes as to the Edwards application. Edwards, to me, is a bright-line rule, now changed from 0 days to 14 days. Where I discussed totality of the circumstances, Chief, was on the issue as to whether a reference is ambiguous.
Okay.
But for this, his totality of the circumstances case, let's look at Edler himself. Well, he's 17. And by the way, there's a lot of discussion in his briefs and his argument about his being 17 and his emotional reaction to being interrogated. People are complex. Nobody's all bad. Nobody's all good. There's the occasional psychopath and the occasional saint, but the rest of us fall in between. I'm not here to say that it didn't bother Edler. It would bother anybody. Arson's a serious charge. But there has been no suggestion ever made in this case about voluntariness. And those issues go to voluntariness, and nobody said that this was involuntary.
Well, he said it was comparable. That you use comparable.
But he keeps making reference to that as
right.
to somehow
yes.
saying that he should get away with a little more ambiguity than somebody else because he's more impacted by the system. If you were to take his totality of circumstances case with Edler, I would argue on the one hand, he's 17, he's young and impressionable. On the other hand, I would say he's an experienced hand at this. He was read his rights 20 days ago. Is he a 10-day guy? Is he a 40-day guy? Is he a 2-year guy? Is he a 10-month guy? And that's what we would have. Bingo, bango, bongo, I agree, is a little weird, but it is something. And opposed to that, we'd be down the cuckoo's nest trying to figure out what is enough time and what is not enough time. And all of a sudden, the callous defendant is going to be treated differently than the inexperienced guy in this particular issue because, you know, you've been read your rights 3 years ago and you look pretty cool then, so you should be approachable, but now you shouldn't. So 14 days, again, I would say to you, I agree with you, Justice, it's arbitrary, but it doesn't mean it's unfair.
I thought the test was if the guy said I didn't want to talk or if he said I want a lawyer, the end. And then he has to reinitiate. Isn't that the rule?
The rule is when a person's in custody and says, I want a lawyer, the end. So long as he remains in continuous custody and under Schatzer now is released for 14 days, or he changes his mind or an attorney is present. Otherwise, very much the end. Which is different than silence. We're not going to get into silence, but silence has a few more avenues of exploration. So that's what I'm saying about Schatzer. I'm saying if you want to go with his rule about the fact that forevermore, you're going to have to drag Roberson in there, and what that rule will be is that for if a person asserts his right to a lawyer once in custody, police are forever barred interrogating him about anything he'd done up until that point for the rest of time.
On that charge.
Well, he tries to make it on that charge, and I'm saying he can't get away with that because Roberson makes it clear that Edwards is not about that charge. Edwards is about custody. You can't start splitting these cases up. They come in a chain. You can't. If you start talking about the state tried that argument in Roberson and was smacked down. And I don't think he wants to really open up that kettle of fish for the convenience of one particular case. I do have a comment to make about the Sessoms case. Sessoms is very different in our case. By the way, the Sessoms police did not answer his question. They ignored his question and plunged right into the reading of the rights. The Sessom police acted quite differently than ours did here. And again, I'm saying that the state should answer the question. In Sessoms, they didn't. He asked the question, and they kept right going, right on going. So and I think that was unfair. About the small talk in the Brewers, what I meant was the record is silent. Nobody knows what happened after he said, can my lawyer be present for this, the remaining 15 minutes? But there is no suggestion on either side that anything was said of any particular of substance on that. Finally, again, I conclude
and
like this.
And it is finally.
This will be finally. I see the red light. If you don't want the finally, I can sit. But finally, is a tightrope. Society's mission of ferreting out crime and criminals, preservation of constitutional rights. In the state's opinion, citizens of Wisconsin have a valid interest in both. An opinion accepting the Schatzer rule, as arbitrary as it might be, the state suggests it's still fair to allow the police in this case to read Edler his Miranda warning, and a finding that Edler knowingly waived these rights serves both interests for the Wisconsin citizen, the preservation of their own rights, and to make sure that criminals are held accountable for their behavior. Apologize for going a little long. Thank you so much, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. I want to thank, on behalf of the court, Mr. Perlman and Mr. Iden for their arguments and for their briefs on yet another Miranda, Edwards, Davis, et cetera, issue. We keep getting different fact situations to which we have to keep applying similar or the same cases. So, which makes it difficult, of course, for defense counsel, prosecution, and law enforcement. With that, we complete our argument in 11 AP 2916 CR, State versus Andrew M. Edler. The court will meet in the conference room immediately, please. We are in...